They are not ready to help as much as at the beginning. They are irritated at times. I generally try to avoid contact with Poles, to be honest.
2 years into the Russia-Ukraine war, millions of Ukrainians are displaced. Is the initial welcome in receiving countries wearing thin? EWTN News In Depth is on the road in Poland. The U.S. Supreme Court gets to weigh in on some important issues. Could that include gender reassignment procedures? Details and analysis with our expert panel.
Even though patients are very appreciative of what we do, I believe that I receive a lot more back from them.
On a mission to provide medical care for low-income people without health insurance, we'll tell you about a Catholic ministry in Missouri. And America will soon learn more about St. Francis Xavier Cabrini. We talk to the lead actress who plays her in the movie opening this week. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Have you seen a decrease in support and funding?
The world now watching the war in Israel.
Yes, and we've noticed this decrease in help, and it is difficult for us. We do what we can, but yes, this financial help can be seen smaller.
The costs of war. While thousands have given their lives, lost their homes and livelihoods, millions of Ukrainians are displaced in other countries, where the welcome for some is growing weary.
So it's time for me to think about another season. I love the Senate. It's been my life.
That, as one of the biggest champions for Ukraine in the U.S. Senate, announces he will step down from his powerful leadership post early next year, ending his stint as the longest-serving Senate leader in U.S. history. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. It is a sea change on Capitol Hill. McConnell held the levers of power firmly for nearly two decades. His shrewd Senate maneuvers helped transform the federal courts. Under his leadership, the Senate confirmed three Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices and more than 200 lower court judges, a legacy that will last for decades. But at age 82, with several recent health scares, he announced on Wednesday that it's time for him to step aside.
One of life's most underappreciated talents is to know when it's time to move on to life's next chapter. So I stand before you today, Mr. President, and my colleagues, to say this will be my last term as Republican leader of the Senate.
McConnell said he's not going anywhere anytime soon. A new Republican leader will be selected by GOP members in November to take the helm next January. And he said his intention is to complete his full Senate term, which runs through 2027. McConnell and the other top leaders on Capitol Hill were in attendance at a meeting in the Oval Office earlier in the week as they met with President Joe Biden. Talk centered on avoiding a government shutdown this weekend and the status of the still stalled foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. House Republicans have refused to bring up the national security package for a vote, despite its approval by a 70-29 bipartisan vote in the Senate. President Biden said its passage is urgent and that the consequences of inaction every day are dire in Ukraine.
The meeting on Ukraine was one of the most intense I have ever encountered in my many meetings in the Oval Office. The four of us all together led. First person to speak was Leader McConnell. Well, the five of us, the President, the Vice President, Leader McConnell, Speaker, Leader Jeffries, and myself, made it so clear how vital this was to the United States.
But the Ukraine aid, along with aid to Israel and Taiwan, remains in congressional limbo on this second anniversary of the war in Ukraine. Correspondent Colin Flynn reported last week from Ukraine. And this week, he visits Poland, the country that has embraced more than 1 million Ukrainian war refugees.
The Ukrainians never thought they'd be staying for so long, and the Polish people didn't expect to be hosting for so long. 2 years ago, EWTN reported from the Ukrainian-Polish border at the height of the Ukrainian immigration crisis, when tens of thousands of mainly women and children were fleeing the war in their country.
As the crisis in Ukraine worsens day by day, the refugees who you can see here behind me coming across the border into Poland, they are uncertain of what the next step in their life will be.
According to the United Nations, 6 million people have left Ukraine since 2022 and settled in different parts of Europe. The largest number stopped in Ukraine's next-door neighbour, Poland, a total of 1.5 million. And here in the Polish town of Rzeszów, around an hour from the Ukrainian border, the population has increased by 50%. Under Polish law, Ukrainian citizens who have fled the war are entitled to free housing, official employment, free healthcare and education, and monthly allowances for each child. Some in Poland want to see the support of their neighbour continue as is, while others are saying enough is enough. Tatiana and Katia are mother and daughter from Kiev. They've been here for the full 2 years.
Most people are lucky that they haven't experienced war. They don't know what it's like. What was it like when you left Ukraine?
It's so difficult because you have this urge to save yourself, but you don't know how to do it. When we fled, shots were being fired, cars weren't able to drive on the road, people were stuck in their homes. Then, when the shelling started, people had to stay in bunkers. It's a really difficult thing for me to talk about. When I came to Poland with my family, we had to start all over again, and, well, that was hard.
At the Caritas Center in Rzeszów, Ukrainian families have gathered to talk to EWTN News about their experience in Poland and how that experience may now be changing.
After 2 years in Poland, how is life today? Because I know that some people have been talking about a change in attitude towards the Ukrainians here in Poland. Have you found that, or how have you found the reception from people?
Well, in my experience, I met good people here from the moment I arrived. The church was really helpful, and people just helped each other, even if they were complete strangers. And thank God it's been like this for 2 years now.
I feel a little bit different. Most people I meet here are sincerely open to us. But I've also met Polish, who are not very open. And it's not my fault I had to come here because of the war. Sometimes I'm nervous because I don't know what reaction I'll get when I tell someone I'm Ukrainian.
Tanya and her two girls are from Zaporizhia, a city in the southeast of Ukraine that was a battleground when the Russian invasion started. Even last year, residential buildings in the city were still being struck by missiles.
I know it's been 2 years, but I'm sure the memories are like it was just yesterday. What do you remember from that time, from when the war started and you having to flee with your family?
Can you ask a question that's easier to answer?
Yeah, sorry.
When Russia's full-scale invasion started, Poland immediately established an aid fund of 600 million euros. That money was distributed to local governments to aid the fleeing Ukrainians in different ways. And originally, the Ukrainians thought that they would be staying for just a few months until Russia surrendered or was beaten.
Did you ever think that you would be here for 2 years, or did you think it would be a shorter stay?
No, I thought I'd be coming here for 1 month or two maximum. I thought it would all be over and we'd be able to go back home.
They didn't expect to be staying for so long. And now some in Poland are wondering if the country can afford to look after and provide for this huge influx of people, especially as so many of their needs have to be met. This has caused some tension between the Polish and Ukrainians living here.
What is the situation like with the Polish people here? Have you found their attitude has changed since you first arrived?
No, it was rather changed. They're tired for us, for war.
Have you felt welcomed over the past 2 years? How have you felt accepted in this country?
As soon as we arrived, all the Polish residents were very friendly. But over time, the friendliness has faded for various reasons. Apparently, they are tired of us.
What do you remember about coming here? And do you like Poland? What is life like?
I really like it. It's really nice here. I feel safe.
Polish protesters persist in blocking 6 out of 9 checkpoints on the border with Ukraine.
And now a new conflict right on the border.
This fracture will be something that will be of serious concern.
Polish farmers are blocking Ukrainian grain from entering their country, saying it is undercutting their grain and preventing them from making a living, even going as far as opening the valves on Ukrainian trains to spill out the grain. Despite the differences of opinions on this immigration crisis, Catholic charities like Caritas are trying to continue to support the Ukrainians in any way they can. Magdalena Kanik is in charge of the local centre and tells me that they are now caring for Ukrainians' long-term needs and even trying to help smooth those relationships between the two neighbours.
In our Caritas, we are very focused on integration within our communities, Polish and Ukrainian community, to help them to live here together and normally, yes.
And it's not just Caritas. The Catholic organization, the Knights of Columbus, are helping too. Driven by their Christian ethos of helping others, regardless of politics or public opinion. Stanislav Lucian is the local representative.
The Knights of Columbus are close to our neighbors in Ukraine, and sometimes it's really difficult for us to imagine the sadness they must be feeling. So we work very closely with the Catholic organization, Caritas. We supply and exchange different things when there is the need.
This war has lasted for 2 years already, and now the Polish government will have to decide later this year whether it extends its benefits for Ukrainians or looks to decrease them. At the same time, with less international attention focused on the war in Ukraine, this has meant less aid is now flowing here. Many of the Ukrainians here feel some of that tension and hostility, but for them, it's nothing compared with what they came from or what they might have to go back to.
What do you think as a young girl when you see the rockets in the sky lighting up like it was daytime, as you said?
For the babies and for young children, it's so dangerous and scary and like a dangerous game.
Like a computer game?
Yes.
Computer game in real life.
In real life, yeah.
I want to say one thing. I am very grateful to the Polish people for their help and support and everything they do. I'm even grateful to those who say unpleasant things. And I'm sure that Ukraine and the rest of the world would help Poland in the same way if they ever needed it.
In Rzeszów, Poland, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in depth.
There's a lot going on in this Ukrainian-Polish relationship. For more analysis, we're joined in studio by George Weigel. Professor Weigel is a distinguished senior fellow and chair of Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's an expert on Poland and Eastern Europe and has written extensively on support for Ukraine. George, it's really great to have you here, especially knowing that this is an emotionally fraught topic for many. We just watched the reactions from Poles and Ukrainians that Colm brought to us. Tell me, what is this relationship between them? What is your analysis of the Ukrainian-Polish relationship?
Let's start with a story.
Yeah.
About a year ago, I met a Polish friend, a distinguished physicist, who had just hosted a colleague from Japan, an equally distinguished physicist. And obviously, they talked about the war going on next door. And after a few minutes of conversation, the Japanese physicist said to my Polish friend, "Where are the camps?" Meaning refugee camps. Mm-hmm. And my Polish friend said, "There aren't any." And the Japanese fellow was shocked at this. I mean, you have refugees, you have refugee camps.
Right,
he said, "Well,
absolutely.
Where are they?" He said, "Well, they're in people's homes." The response of Poland to this extraordinary set of events next door and this flood of refugees has been nothing short of exceptional, for all the reasons we just watched.
Right, right.
These people have been welcomed. They've been given health care benefits. Their children are going to Polish schools. It's certainly going to cause some friction
right.
over time. But the important big story here is there are no camps.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and that needs to be focused on. Secondly, I think it's important to say that the church has been quite extraordinary in all of this. Both the church in Poland, the church around the world, the Knights of Columbus have done exceptional work, as was just pointed out. The third thing that Americans need to realize is that this problem is not going away. We have to grow up and face it. And we're going to be dealing with it and its ramifications for a long time to come. The present estimates are that it is going to cost $1 trillion to repair the damage that Russia has continued to inflict on Ukraine. $1 trillion.
Yeah.
And that's before we get to the human cost of this,
mm-hmm.
which has been exceptional. So I'm glad you're focusing attention on this. I'm glad we're acknowledging how extraordinary Poland's response to the crisis next door has been. Polish-Ukrainian history is not a happy one in many decades and centuries. And yet the immediate reaction of Poles to refugee Ukrainians suggested that this is still a Christian country.
That's right.
This is still a Christian.
And it's so with that long view of history, of past relationships and what's going on now, how far will that Christian welcome stretch? Let's start there and then we can talk about how it can be helped to stretch.
I think it's important for Europe as a whole, particularly Poland, but not just Poland, to feel that the United States is in this with Europe.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be in it in the same way. But if this childishness on Capitol Hill, there's no other word for it, this is childishness on Capitol Hill continues, and there is a real break between Europe and the United States on the question of Ukraine and support for Ukraine, then we are heading into very, very deep and troubled waters indeed. So that's the first thing I think
mm-hmm.
is important. Europeans need to know that America understands that this is America's battle, too. There are going to be tensions here. I mean, this is obvious. You can't have 1.5 million displaced persons land in your country speaking a different language, bearing a different history. Ukrainian Catholics worship in a different way. Most
right.
of them are Greek Catholics rather than Latin Rite, and not expect some tensions. But to go back to where I began, there are no camps.
Right.
And that's an extraordinary accomplishment.
A different kind of welcome. But something that I know that you would be an expert in is this anti-communism move by the church, the history of that, which you've written with John Paul II. Is that stance for Catholics in particular, not just American Catholics, and supporting Ukrainians in this plight, is this very Catholic because of that? Is it the fulfillment of that?
I think it's a basic Christian instinct to help the neighbor. It's the Good Samaritan parable writ large. This is pre-ideological. I mean, Poles are fiercely anti-communist. Mm-hmm. They're also fiercely anti-Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But the immediate response, I think, did not touch either old Cold War memories or aggravations. It was a deeply Christian response. Now, it's also important for us to recognize whose fault all of this is. This is Mr. Putin's fault. He is conducting a genocidal war, the purposes of which he described 2 days before the invasion 2 years ago as the eradication of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't backed off of that 1 millimeter. And in the recent, I will use the word, murder of Alexei Navalny, he's made it very clear that he's not backing off on his own autocracy, homicidal autocracy at home. This is a long-term problem. We've got to get out of social media think and, internet
yeah.
war game
right.
think and understand that, you know, where we are in this struggle right now is where things were in the Second World War 2 months before the United States got into it. This could go on for quite a while.
That's right. Yeah. Particularly on that note, just we've got 1 minute left. Your thoughts, you've shared about this, on why this aid is vital for the survival of democracy. You've made that clear. So knowing that this is the comparison that you're making to World War II, why is that vital?
Putin is trying to undo the verdict of history in the Cold War. He's trying to rebuild the Russian Empire. He's trying to rebuild the Soviet Empire. He's trying to destabilize Central Europe, the Baltics, Poland, etc. This cannot be allowed to happen. The Ukrainians are fighting our fight at this point. They deserve our support. And people need to grow up in the House of Representatives and understand that that is the task that history has laid before them right now.
Well, we know that with the recent funeral, which we're about to talk about, we have a lot on our consciences. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you for having me.
Thousands of Russians defied the Kremlin to pay their respects on Friday to opposition leader Alexei Navalny after a battle between authorities and his family over the release of his body and the terms of his funeral. Busloads of riot police were on hand as a hearse hurried past the crowds to a church where a brief ceremony was held before his burial. Navalny could be seen in an open casket as his parents bade him farewell. When others inside the church approached the coffin to pay their respects, the Orthodox Christian service was cut short. But thousands remained in line with flowers outside, tightly monitored by police.
Can you tell me why have you come here today to pay your respects?
I came from St. Petersburg.
From St. Petersburg?
St. Petersburg. And I came here because I loved his person. I loved his hero. He's the real hero.
Alexei Navalny,
of course. And for me, it's a personal tragedy. I want to say to him, farewell.
Those outside the church said they knew the risks of showing up with their faces uncovered, but they came anyway. They were joined in the crowd by the U.S., French, and German ambassadors to Russia. Navalny was buried in a cemetery nearby. The Kremlin maintains the 47-year-old's death 2 weeks ago in a Siberian prison colony was from natural causes. With Russia threatening its Nordic and Baltic neighbors, history this week as Sweden's bid to join NATO passed an important milestone.
When Sweden also becomes a NATO member, the Nordic countries will have a common defense for the first time in 500 years. We are neighbors, we remain friends, and we become allies.
Sweden has famously been a neutral country with no military alignments for centuries, but applied for membership in NATO in 2022 after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. New members must be unanimously approved by other member nations, and Hungary had blocked Sweden for almost 2 years until its parliament finally voted to end the standoff on Monday. It will be the second expansion of NATO's ranks in a year after Finland joined NATO last year. More grim news from Gaza. Hamas health officials now estimate more than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed and 70,000 more wounded since the Israeli-Hamas war began nearly 5 months ago. Those same officials claim more than 100 people were killed on Thursday alone when hundreds of people swarmed a rare humanitarian aid convoy in northern Gaza. The crowds are seen here in this aerial footage released by Israeli Defense Forces. Israeli and Gazan officials are trading blame. The Palestinians say Israeli forces opened fire on the crowd. Israel's military says many died in the crush of a stampede. There's much more ahead on EWTN News in Depth. Next, the U.S. Supreme Court and big cases this term. One could shape the future of free speech on the internet. Another potential case could involve gender transitioning for minors. Our expert legal panel weighs in.
We call on the state of Alabama to provide immediate, complete, and permanent access to IVF care for the women and families of Alabama.
And later, the blowback continues after the Alabama Supreme Court's ruling saying frozen embryos deserve legal protection. The political scramble to keep in vitro fertilization.
It's so fun to do this. So fun to take care of patients and not care about if they're going to pay or not. It's just great.
Medical care without the cost. We'll tell you how one Catholic diocese in Middle America is providing free, top-flight care to those without health insurance.
I was over the moon. I was so happy to play her that everything just seemed easy.
And later, she plays a saint in the movie Cabrini, opening on March 8th. A talk with lead actress Christiana Delana. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
The Supreme Court heard oral argument this week in two high-stakes cases centered around free speech on social media. The justices' ultimate decision could drastically impact free speech on the internet and how millions of Americans interact with online information. The twin cases centered around similar laws in Florida and Texas that prohibit social media companies from blocking or removing user content that they find hateful or objectionable. NetChoice, a group that represents the tech industry and is suing to block the laws, says the regulations go against social media companies' First Amendment rights to decide what speech to allow on private platforms. Attorney Paul Clement argued on behalf of NetChoice and told the court the broad scope of the laws could have unintended consequences.
These same companies are getting hammered by people that say we're not doing enough to keep material that's harmful to children off of these sites. And yet these laws make it impossible for us to keep material that's harmful to children off of our sites.
On the other side, Florida Solicitor General Henry Whitaker argued that social media are like public entities, such as a newspaper or phone company, and should be regulated as such.
The telephone company and the delivery service have no First Amendment right to use their services as a choke point to silence those they disfavor.
The High Court will release its decision by the end of the term in late June. Its ruling could shape free speech in what many now call the new public square, and how both states and tech companies can influence content posted on their sites. Another hot-button issue under consideration at the court this term, gender transitions for minors. As dozens of states move to either ban or protect gender reassignment treatments called gender-affirming care by advocates, some groups are asking the Supreme Court to intervene. Three cases have been submitted to the Supreme Court over bans on gender transitions for minors. Two cases ask the High Court to reverse bans in Kentucky and Tennessee. A third asks the justices to allow Idaho's ban on gender transitions to take effect after a lower court judge blocked it earlier this year. Another case on the court's desk, MC and JC versus Indiana, brings up the issue of parental rights. Parents Mary and Jeremy Cox's teenage son began to identify as a girl, but because of their Catholic faith, they did not use his preferred pronouns. Indiana Child Services stepped in and removed their son from their home, even though it found no evidence of abuse or neglect and never returned him to his family. The parents hope a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court could affirm their rights as parents to teach their children their deeply held Catholic beliefs on gender and sexuality, and to protect others from losing custody of their children over their religious beliefs in the future. Two legal experts join us now to discuss these cases. Lori Windham is vice president and senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. She's the attorney for the Cox family as they bring their case to the Supreme Court. And Josh Payne is a partner at a law firm that helps detransitioners sue their doctors for pushing gender transition surgeries. The law firm is Campbell Miller Payne. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. Lori, let's start with you. What happened to the Cox family? How does the right of a child to change their gender supersede parental rights?
That's exactly what we're asking here, Melissa. Mary and Jeremy Cox are living every parent's nightmare because they would not change those pronouns and go along with a gender, attempted gender transition for their son. He was removed from their care by state officials, even after they investigated for months and found out that these were fit parents. They had not abused or neglected him in any way. They still used the disagreement over gender as a reason to keep him out of their home until he turned 18. What's shocking is the Indiana courts upheld this, and now the Supreme Court is their last stop and their last hope to make sure this doesn't happen again to others.
So then what is that hope? What could the Supreme Court do? Could they force Indiana to return him to his family? What comes next?
What the Supreme Court could do is overturn the decision below, wipe the stain off of Mary and Jeremy's record. They have other young children at home. They don't want something like this to happen again. And send a clear signal to lower courts and to states that you cannot interfere with parental rights, you cannot interfere with religious liberty by removing kids from the home of loving parents just because they disagree over gender.
Josh, let's talk about these transition bans. You recently filed an amicus brief on behalf of detransitioners in Idaho's case to the Supreme Court. And in that brief, you shared the stories of numerous detransitioners, people who are trying to come back to their original gender, who believe that gender-affirming care would resolve their gender dysphoria and allow them to live healthy lives. But as you say in the brief, they learned through these experiences that such interventions did not resolve their mental health issues or gender dysphoria, but only caused physical harm and increased their distress as they realized their bodies had been irreversibly altered based on a false promise. How do you hope the stories of these detransitioners will help Idaho's case with the Supreme Court?
We do hope that their stories are heard and listened to, and we know that they're effective and that they help cut through the noise and really put a face to why these regulations are so necessary and so important. In the lower courts, in the Kentucky and Tennessee case that you mentioned, that the government and the private plaintiff challengers are trying to get the Supreme Court to hear, we also filed an amicus brief in support of the Kentucky and Tennessee laws. And in its ruling, upholding those laws and protecting minors from these dangerous procedures, the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit cited our amicus brief on behalf of detransitioners and said what this brief shows and what the detransitioners show through their testimony is that the category of transgender, such as it is, as the private plaintiffs are claiming, it is a protected category, is not an immutable characteristic. Because people can change and detransition, as our clients have, after they realize, in their words, that they were misled into these physical changes to their bodies that did not help their mental health, gender dysphoria problems, but instead simply left them with mental anguish and, in many cases, without their natural healthy bodies and without their body parts.
Absolutely. Well, Josh, are there any common themes then in the stories of these detransitioners? Your law firm is one of very few that is helping them with their plight, which has been much silenced in the mainstream media.
That's right. At Campbell Miller Payne, our firm, we were established almost 1 year ago to represent detransitioners and help them seek justice from the medical providers, the clinics that put them through these treatments. As I said, our clients feel that they have been misled into these procedures. They are seeking justice for themselves and their families, and they are hoping that by bringing a case, they not only stand up for themselves in seeking that justice, but that they also serve as a cautionary tale in hopefully preventing this tragedy from happening to others.
Now, Lori, these detransitioner clients and stories are the worst case scenario for your clients right now. Are there any other states where children are being taken from their parents in this way?
Yes, Monse. California and Washington have both passed laws that authorize state officials to take custody or to refuse to tell a parent where a child is if that child, for the purpose of allowing that child to access what they deem gender-affirming care. Other states like Maine are considering similar bills. What we've said all along about the Cox's case is that if this can happen in Indiana, this can happen in Indiana.
Now, Lori, it seems that a place like California, we would expect to have that kind of a reaction pushing gender ideology, violating religious freedom and parental rights. But Indiana, that's quite surprising. Why is it happening there?
Well, I think it really does send a frightening message that state officials in any state, if they have these views about gender transitions, can remove a child from a parent's home, and it can take months, if not longer, for parents to be able to clear their names and get their child back.
That's true. Well, now, Josh, it's not just government regulators and bureaucrats that are at fault for some of this. Sometimes it's medical associations, but this time a medical association has actually done something positive. The American College of Pediatricians has concluded that social transition, puberty blockers, and cross-sex hormones have no demonstrable long-term benefit on psychosocial well-being of adolescents with gender dysphoria. Do you think this finding could impact the high court's decisions when it comes to gender-affirming care or so-called gender-affirming care?
I think it's very important that all courts, and of course the Supreme Court especially, have available to them the best science possible, and that the experts are really able to explain what the science is telling us, what it is not telling us, and what it can't tell us. And where it is and isn't being deployed appropriately. In our medical malpractice cases, of course, we have experts giving opinions about the standards of care and how that was carried out in specific cases. Something like the American College of Pediatricians is very important because it shows industry-wide, if you will, the expectations that are there for how children should be protected and how they should be cared for and what is and is not appropriate. Going back to the Tennessee and Kentucky cases, which are pending, the government, the federal government, and the private plaintiff challengers asking the Supreme Court to take those cases and reverse the Sixth Circuit, which upheld the laws to protect the minors. There is a very good friend of the court amicus brief there filed on behalf of the state of Alabama that lays out the lack of scientific evidence underpinning the so-called standards put forward by WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Healthcare. And that is a document I commend to everyone to read because it really shows that the so-called science that's being used to push these procedures is very much lacking and not what people have been led to believe.
Well, there's certainly concerns for religious freedom, parental rights, and, of course, actual science at the courts. We'll be watching this very carefully. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
News headlines are next in the Week in Review. Alabama's IVF court ruling runs into political headwinds. Pope Francis heads to the hospital for a flu checkup and a theme for World Grandparents Day. We'll be right back.
What happens here today in these offices will be looked at by the rest of the country. This potentially could be a roadmap for other states to restrict access to IVF or a roadmap on how to protect access to IVF and family building.
Advocates of in vitro fertilization gathered outside the Alabama State House on Wednesday, asking state lawmakers to protect the fertility treatment. At least three major IVF providers in Alabama put IVF on ice after the Alabama Supreme Court ruled that embryos are legally children. This continued fallout over the state court's ruling tops the Week in Review. The Alabama lawmakers' urgent push to protect IVF highlights the political tightrope many pro-life Republican lawmakers face ahead of the election season. Both chambers of Alabama's Senate advanced a bill on Thursday that would protect fertility clinics and patients from facing criminal prosecution for discarding embryos in the IVF process. The measures received widespread support from both sides of the aisle and even passed unanimously in the state Senate. The bill now heads to the governor's desk, where it could be signed into law early next week. Some Republican lawmakers spoke to the protesters outside the state house and promised to bring clarity.
When you walk in these doors, you will have advocates that you'll be speaking to. There's no reason to be afraid. We want to fix this as much as you do.
In Florida, state lawmakers pressed pause on a fetal personhood bill that would protect unborn children under state law. Opponents of the bill voiced concerns that the policy's broad scope might impact couples' access to in vitro fertilization. State senator and sponsor of the bill, Aaron Grawl, said more work needs to be done on the bill, and it's important that lawmakers get the policy right. If the bill moves ahead, Florida would join a handful of other states that allow civil lawsuits over the death of an unborn child. As the country heads into a heated election season where abortion is likely to be a major issue, many GOP leaders across the country are reconciling their pro-life policies with broad support for IVF. Many pro-life politicians in the party have openly voiced their support for IVF, as has likely GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump.
And so what I think the goal is to make sure that we can find a pathway to ensure that parents who otherwise may not have the opportunity to have a child will be able to have access to the IVF process and become parents and give life to babies.
I believe in the sanctity of every human life, always have. And because of that, I support IVF and its availability.
Like the overwhelming majority of Americans, including the vast majority of Republican, conservatives, Christians, and pro-life Americans, I strongly support the availability of IVF for couples who are trying to have a precious little beautiful baby. I support it.
Many Republican lawmakers also said they believe the IVF issue should be left up to the states. But Catholic Church teaching has always been clear on the issue. In vitro fertilization is morally inadmissible. Carter Sneed, law professor at the University of Notre Dame, explains why the treatment is incompatible with God's design for marriage.
The church has been consistent and unwavering in its view that it matters how babies are conceived, how they come into the world, and that IVF is a kind of imperfect way of pursuing the building of a family. It fractures the unitive and procreative dimensions in the same way that artificial contraception fractures the unitive and procreative dimensions, except in this case, it results in the creation of a new living member of the human family, which adds additional ethical concerns.
Now, while the Catholic Church does not condone the use of IVF, it does encourage medical support for couples who struggle with infertility. President Biden had his annual physical this week. His doctor says the 81-year-old is fit for duty. In recent months, many Americans have expressed concern that the president's age and possible mental decline make him unfit to lead the nation. Biden's doctor attempted to put those concerns to rest, reporting that he remains fit to successfully execute his presidential duties. His physical noted spinal arthritis, which has led to his stiff walking, but found that it has not increased significantly from last year. This physical will likely be the last update on Biden's health voters will have before the election in November. A doctor visit this week also for Pope Francis. It came after his general audience earlier this week.
Non dimentichiamo i popoli che soffrono a causa della guerra.
During his remarks on Wednesday about the dangers of envy and pride, the Pope also appealed for peace in the Middle East and Ukraine. He then felt well enough to personally greet many of the faithful at the end of the weekly audience. After the audience, the pontiff's white Fiat was seen in the streets of Rome, headed for a hospital in central Rome for a one-hour visit. Pope Francis had been suffering from the flu and a cough and had diagnostic tests. But Thursday, he had resumed a full schedule, meeting with several different groups, presumably feeling better. Do not cast me off in my old age. That is the theme released in preparation for the fourth World Day of Grandparents and the Elderly, to be held on Sunday, July 28th. The Vatican says this year's theme is meant to call attention to the loneliness many elderly people feel in our throwaway culture. The World Day takes place the fourth Sunday of July near the feast of Saints Joachim and Anne, the grandparents of Jesus. It's meant to show tenderness and affectionate attention to fragile members of our communities. We'll be right back.
It's a healthcare clinic on wheels provided by the church, offering doctors, exam rooms, and medical resources, driving them to communities that need it the most. I'm Mark Irons with that story coming up.
An effort to help those who can't afford health care is on the road in the Archdiocese of St. Louis, Missouri. Medical volunteers, many retired, are providing much-needed help to people living without health insurance in rural parts of the state. Mark Irons has this Catholic Life report.
Because people need help. A lot of people come here and need help.
Like many others, Tina Frank visits the Peace Pantry for those basic necessities. Inside, she can find food or clothing. For those with low or no income living outside St. Louis, Missouri, it's a helpful stop. And today, another necessity has driven over and parked outside because the visitors inside the pantry need more than bread alone.
But along with those basic needs are health care needs. It's a basic right for being a human being.
With its rural parish mobile clinic, the Archdiocese of St. Louis provides health care on wheels. Traveling to remote areas, it's ready for walk-ins.
This is our van.
At no cost to the patients, medical care given here, complete with doctors, nurses, exam rooms, and prescriptions, is filling the needs of the rural poor.
God bless them, because people need it. There's a lot of people that don't have it, that need a doctor.
While most healthcare providers want to see proof of insurance before they serve patients, inside the rural parish clinic, they serve patients who have no health insurance.
There are lots of people in the rural communities who don't have any insurance, and the solution for them is to not go.
But thanks to this clinic, patients like Jason Fatch can go to see Dr. Mary Hastings, just one of the volunteers here. For Jason, this means a lot.
Well, I tell you, I don't have any money. No money. Not a house to, you know, I don't have my own house. Nothing.
He says one of the few things he does have is his health. And he needs to take care of it because he has others to care for.
Because I have a lot of people that depend on me. I've got daughters and family and friends. And
private donations and grant money allow this medical unit, along with another mobile dental clinic, to keep running in the Archdiocese. Some of the patients may have jobs, but no health insurance. Regardless of work, they all experience poverty.
I'd like to not think that I'm the only one, you know, that could benefit from these kind of services, you know, in this area. I think these services could be and need to be a lot of other places, you know.
Vicki Bamer, a registered nurse, is one of the medical professionals who volunteer time and expertise. She says it's all worth it.
I feel that every day I come to clinic, I leave clinic receiving more than what I have given.
Dr. Thomas Johans shares the same feeling.
This is a very spiritual outlet. I mean, you're doing something very good for people, and God is good, and God can only do good. So if I'm doing good, I'm doing God's work.
It all starts with prayer. Dr. Hastings says the medical team will go to Mass together, share prayer intentions, and then serve.
I think the church does a lot. The next step is to take it into healthcare.
She believes this type of ministry allows the church, the body of Christ, to access other areas where people are hurting.
I think it's time to start doing more in healthcare, because what I find is that this white coat gives me access to a lot. It gives me access to things about domestic violence, food insecurity, or mental health needs, and all sorts of things.
So as they are meeting the physical and medical needs of people,
I am hoping that people see Jesus through us, and we're not preaching to them, but we are acting the way Jesus would want us to act. And we're doing an evangelization by our behavior with our patients.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
A true fulfillment of the Great Commission. When we return, we go to the movies. How do you prepare to play a saint?
I talked to the actress who plays Mother Cabrini, the patron saint of immigrants, in a film opening this week. Insight into her role and Mother Cabrini's story when we return.
You ask me to fund the needs of impoverished Italians entirely from impoverished Italians.
I'm giving you an order, Mother.
the life and works of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini on the big screen. Next week, a film will debut showcasing her mission, which has now spread around the world. I recently spoke with the lead actress who played Cabrini, Christiana Delana, about taking on such an iconic role. Christiana, it's so great to be with you, especially around the legacy of this beautiful saint for us. Take us back a little bit about how you found out about this role and the legacy, why the legacy is so meaningful for you.
So I really did find out about her very much through being offered the role. I started researching about her a lot and realized that she was a wonderful, powerful woman that I should have known about and people should know about. And the fact that now we have a story about her that is based on true facts of her life, and it isn't just the product of someone's imagination, and it isn't just dramatized for entertainment, but it's actually a meaningful story, and it has historical true facts in it. You know, it makes it even more powerful and more important because it's true events. And I just believe that the Cabrini's legacy should just be very proud, because finally a story about her is out in the world and people can talk about her. A discussion can be open about who she was and what she did.
How do you prepare to play a saint? What kind of a preparation goes into not just a character, but someone that, by many accounts, has been attributed miracles and all kind of supernatural realities?
We never really address that, in the sense that we wanted her to be very human. You don't become a saint because you are a saint. You become a saint because you become one, because you do it with your actions. She was very human in the sense that she did heroic acts, and all her deeds are things that we can do nowadays. So she was an example for people. Obviously, the fact that, you know, the fact that she's also miracles have been attributed to her makes her obviously a very important religious figure for all those who believe. But she's also someone who, not necessarily Catholic or Christian people can relate to. They can relate to her. Everyone can relate to her, and how special she was, because she understood the importance of you know, being a community and the responsibility towards our neighbor, which is a very Christian message, yes, but it's a very human message. So everyone can relate to that.
What kind of challenges did you face, though, in playing Mother Cabrini? Was there anything that was a particular roadblock that you had to overcome?
Right now, what I remember is the first scene when I see Victoria for the first time. We meet for the first time in the slums of New York, and she, I'm already beginning my mission. The very moment I arrive in New York, I remember that was a little difficult, just because it was the very first one we shot.
Was there a scene that you thought was iconic to the Mother Cabrini that you got to know in playing her?
Well, one of my favorite scenes is the Senate speech. I prepared for that a lot. Mm-hmm. I remember recording myself sometimes to just see what it might look like. I felt very emotional all throughout the entire day of shooting. And you normally, like, you start with a first very emotional take, and then it becomes a little bit more, you know, you get more comfortable in it. Whereas for me, it was the whole thing was very, again, very emotional, very powerful. I felt empowered by those words, and I felt I was her. I was very much her. So I just think that's probably one of my favorite ones, along with all the scenes that I played with David Morse. The opposition that we had, it really helped the story, really helped build the character and the whole story. First of all, he's a wonderful actor, and then we became really good friends because he's a wonderful human being as well.
This movie, it's launching on International Women's Day. What about Mother Cabrini is so important for women around the world to emulate, to follow, to imitate in some ways?
her relentlessness, her, you know, strong will and believing that she could achieve those things, and the self-confidence. You know, she always said, begin the mission, the means will come. I quote that line to this day. After we shot that in 2021, the film was, you know, is already, you know, it's been shot for a long time ago now. So I just think that they should see her as an example in that sense. And we have many examples of that. And why not having a nun as well, you know, to kind of, you know, break that stereotype of woman that if she wears a habit, she's not capable of those things, but only praying. No, she was, you know, she put into action her beliefs. And I just think that's already very powerful. She says at some point, I build my entire career on the no's that I've received. You know, it was her strength.
What then would you say is the one gift that she gave you in this journey of playing her, getting to know her? There's just some phrases that stay with you. What gift did Mother Cabrini give you in this moment?
The one sentence, one line that I always use is, you can serve your purpose or you can serve your weakness.
We look forward to seeing you play this role and bring Mother Cabrini back to life.
Thank you.
The movie on the life of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini opens Friday, March 8th, International Women's Day. I know I'm getting my watch party together now. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again same time next week when our team of correspondents reporting from several corners of America bring you a special program dedicated to the problem of homelessness. We hope to see you then.